Welcome to Zambia's hottest radio talk show, The Hot Seat, exclusive to Hot FM 87.7.
A very good morning to you. Welcome to Tuesday's edition of the Hot Seat Radio program. I'm your host. My name is Peter Zulu Jr. On the program today, we discuss the work of the Charter Cities Institute. Now, the Charter City Institute is a non-profit organization dedicated to building the ecosystem for charter cities and tackling humanity's most pressing challenges, such as global poverty, rapid urbanization, and conflict and migration caused by poverty, war, and climate change. The program series entitled Charter Cities, Uncovering Special Economy Cities, thus seeking to socialize the concept of charter cities and to engage people in discussing about charter cities as an innovative development model that can, you know, address challenges of the 21st century. Now, to help us with this discussion, I have in studio, I'm joined by Africa leader Mwanda Piri and urban researcher Heba El Hanafi in studio. Good morning, ladies. It's good to have you on the show this morning.
Good morning, Peter. Good morning to the listeners. We're glad to be here.
Thank you so much for having us. Good morning.
All right. I should make mention that we are live on different platforms. We're live on Kwito FM on 93.3 FM in Lusaka, surrounding areas as well. We're live in Eastern Province on Kanela FM in Lundazi on 97.7 FM. We're live on DSTV channel 912 countrywide and GoTV channel 301 countrywide. You can also follow the proceedings of his show live on our Facebook platform, which is Hot FM Zambia. If you want to have, you know, contribute or just give an opinion to what will be discussed on this program, feel free to do that on our Facebook Live link. Just leave us a comment. We'll be able to put the questions forward to our panelists this morning, and they'll be able to respond to you a little later on in the show. I want us to kick off our conversation this morning, you know, by you telling us about the Charter Cities. Who are you, and when were you established?
Thank you so much. So we were established in 2017, but perhaps let me start with who we are. As you already alluded to, we are the Charter Cities Institute, a nonprofit organization, and we aim to empower new cities with better governance so that we can have better outcomes in terms of investment attraction and the attendant jobs that actually often come with investments. And ultimately, really, we're driven by this motive, this passion to be able to help developing countries alleviate poverty. So in a nutshell, that's who we are as the Charter Cities Institute. And as I alluded to, we were established in 2017. Our head office is in Washington, D.C. But some great news is that we recently established our regional office here in Lusaka, Zambia, last year in December. Mm-hmm. So we're very excited to push forward this development agenda, not just in Zambia, but across sub-Saharan Africa as well. And maybe just to add, part of what we do really is we're dedicated to creating this ecosystem for charter cities. And essentially, we try to do this by ensuring that we help countries in terms of coming up with a legal, with the regulatory and planning frameworks that can promote new thriving cities that ultimately contribute to alleviating poverty.
Okay.
Beyond that, we convene key stakeholders, governments, policymakers, academia, think tanks, all the relevant stakeholders needed to ensure that cities can actually be developed and thrive. And we also carry out quite a number of different researchers, policy analysis work. We convene events. But anyway, in a nutshell, that's who we are. And we're happy to talk more about our work as we go along.
Okay. Now, I want to find out from you, from what you've just, you know, highlighted to us now, what's your vision and what's the motivation for developing charter cities?
So a good way to understand why we do what we do, as you mentioned, is to really look at the motivation, right? So if we look at urbanization, the global south is rapidly urbanizing. In fact, we like to say the last wave of urbanization is happening across the global south. According to the United Nations, by 2050, about 2.5 billion new urban residents will be added to cities. So that's quite huge. And then if you bring it down to Africa, we're talking about nearly 1 billion new urban residents. And then bringing
Is that good or bad?
It can be good if well managed, if harnessed. Mm. But it can also be, a major risk in the sense of, some of the constraints that come with a rapidly urbanizing population. population that's not well catered for in terms of, you know, employment creation, in terms of providing the infrastructure that's needed, the municipal services. We're talking about, you know, adequate schools, hospitals, housing, for instance, which is a major, you know, constraint in Africa. If you look at most of the cities, and Lusaka, you know, is facing a similar challenge. So you see a lot of informal settlements coming up. The city is rapidly urbanizing. More people are moving in. The population is expanding. Mm. But are we creating employment at the same pace, I beg your pardon, to sort of, you know, be commensurate with the increase in population? So if not well managed, can definitely be, you know, a ticking time bomb.
Okay.
And maybe if you just allow me to add, what is interesting about, you know, cities, just going back to your question, if you look at history, right, the way cities developed in the West, even the, you know, East Asian countries, as cities became more urban, right, you're increasing the number of urban residents that you have. We saw this corresponding increase in terms of income growth, in terms of availability of, you know, higher productivity jobs that would then, you know, lift them up from poverty. But what we see is, you know, sort of the reverse, you know, this concept of structural transformation. We do see the migration happening from rural to, you know, urban areas. People are looking for employment, but then they are getting into, you know, lower productivity employment, which doesn't really offer them a lot of, you know, higher income that you need to really push somebody out of poverty. So that's part of the challenge I wanted to just, you know, emphasize. If well managed, cities as they expand can actually be, you know, sources of economic growth, of economic development. But if not, then you see cities, you know, being, you know, having a lot of informal settlements, slums, water, storage challenges that are quite commonplace here as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I want to talk about decentralization, because I know that we have a new government in place. They're just 1 year in. They're big on decentralization. First of all, explain what charter cities are and how do they relate to decentralization? Because we know this is big on our government's agenda.
A very short definition of what charter cities are is simply to say new cities with new rules or better rules, right? Mm. But a more technical definition would be to think of charter cities as these new cities with a special jurisdiction to be able to come up, you know, with internal business regulations that help to mobilize private capital in terms of, you know, investors coming in, that help to mobilize urban developers to come in to partner with, you know, local authorities or the government to then, you know, build the infrastructure needed for these cities. So essentially, charter cities relate to decentralization in the sense that they entail devolving significant policy as well as regulatory making responsibilities to the city administration. So a higher degree of decentralization beyond just, you know, devolving functions, but actually allowing these, you know, local authorities to experiment with rules, to come up with localized rules that are good for attracting investors to come in, for jobs to be created, for residents to want to live in these cities. So in that sense, aligns very well with what the government is aspiring for, but takes it a little bit further in that, you know, you're really giving more power to, you know, the local administration to really also think about, you know, the type of policies that need to be implemented.
Okay. You refer to charter cities as a special economic zones version 2.0. How do charter cities, you know, compare to special economic zones? Because we have those in the country right now.
Yes, so that is the other definition that we like to put forth. So in Zambia, the Special Economic Zone program is referred to as the Multi-Facility Economic Zone,
yeah.
Right? So charter cities are very similar, but as you said, we think of them as being Vision 2.0 or this next generation of special economic zones. Taking it a bit further in the sense that now you're looking at a larger scale, right? With special economic zones, or the MFAs as we call them, they are, you know, located within a city. It's an area within a city. But with charter cities, we're saying the entire city should be designated as being a special jurisdiction, which, as I said before, should have, you know, more devolved powers to be able to come up with, you know, the internal business regulations that would be able to lead to more efficient administrative processes as well as commercial regulations. So similar in that these are special areas. They have been delineated, but different in the sense that with charter cities, larger scale, and the the reason for that is if you're thinking about, you know, having more broader impact, right? Mm-hmm. You want to have as many people, as many residents operating under good rules. So at a city scale, you're essentially allowing a larger area to be able to operate, you know, with, you know, to be able to be under better rules and regulations. So you can harness greater economies of scale. You can harness greater agglomeration economies. These are the, you know, productivity gains you get, the cost-saving gains that come as people cluster and businesses cluster together as well. And beyond that, with charter cities, we really think about multi-industry. And I guess this is where with the MFES program, there are a lot of similarities because ours is multi, you know, facilities. So in the name itself, we're looking at residential. This is the Zambia program, right? We're looking at residential, we're looking at commercial as well as industrial. And that's very similar to charter cities. In other countries, you will find, you know, there'll just be maybe industrial parks focusing on maybe manufacturing, assembly. Yeah. So with charter cities, we think about how do you foster economic diversification. So you don't want to just hone in on a particular industry, but you want to think about services that, you know, complement. You want to think about residents that can come in and also, you know, drive demand for certain goods within that city. And I think another key distinction, and this is where we say, you know, it's sort of an improved version of special economic zones, right?
Yeah.
A key distinction, as I said, is this element of devolved authority.
And that's where I want us to go into detail. I think we'll do that a little later on the show. You can expand on that when it comes to laws and regulation within these charter cities. I want to switch to Heba here. Because according to the UN estimates, the global population is rapidly expanding and nearly 70% of the world's population will be living in urban areas by the year 2050. But some of our cities are not well planned to accommodate, you know, this expanding urban population. Why is that?
I think it majorly goes back to our understanding of what is the meaning of city and how we look at cities, right? So cities... And that goes back to why do people move to cities, right? People move to cities for two reasons. Mm-hmm. Because living in a city, you have better access to jobs and you have better access to services. So at the end of the day, when you look at cities, you look at cities as labor markets. People here move here for better opportunities, period.
Mm-hmm.
So when you look at cities from that perspective, as a labor market, people move here for jobs, people move here for services, then you plan the cities on three main things. First off, the people who are moving here, so people. Second, businesses and the economy. So you make sure that when people move here, they find a job, they find a good service, they find things. And the last thing and the most important, something we stress on a lot in the Church Institute, is the good rules. So how are we going to govern those people? How are we going to govern those businesses? How are we going to attract those investments? So when you think of those three things and you try to align them together, and you start planning cities, this is when cities become effective. This is when cities become attractive to people. This is when people move to cities and they actually have a huge improvement in the service they're getting and the jobs they're having. And as simple as it sounds, right? People, businesses, and good rules, it's actually very hard to do in real life, right? Because those three things are governed by so many government institutions. There are so many private stakeholders. There are so many people that are working on those three things. So getting together those three main elements in planning is actually have proven again and again and again quite difficult. But to simplify it, it's just those three elements and getting them together, and this is how you plan better cities, or at least try to start thinking about planning better cities.
You've said better cities a lot of times. So how can cities be planned better?
How can cities be planned better? As I said, planning them around those three things, and also try to rethink the ideas of planning, right? So planning has historically been a top-down process where someone sits in their office and just, you know, plan streets or set out like building regulations and all of this kind of stuff. And it has proven again and again to be inefficient, doesn't really attract investment, it doesn't really does what the city, why people come to the city for. So for instance, thinking about the different agglomerations in the city as a set of activities that different stakeholders can come together and work on. And this is where we stress a lot on private-public partnerships in cities, and we see how effective they are. The government cannot do anything, but if we think about that, the things that are happening in the city as a set of activities that really provide a lot of help when it comes to planning better cities. The second thing is the top-down and bottom-up activities. So again, planning is not a top-down process where someone sits in their office and they do all the planning, but it's something that has to come from the technical assistant, but also from the bottom up, from the businesses that are being attracted to the city, from the people needs, which always change over time as the population increases, as the population changes, as people move from poverty to middle classes. This is something that's always dynamic. And that's why we always refer, and the third thing I always refer to is thinking about the city planning as a short-term process and long-term process, right? So there are certain things in city planning that are essential. Infrastructure, right? So this is always have to be on top of everything. You have to provide infrastructure. But there are certain things in infrastructure, for instance, that can come on a long-term process, right? So we can plan for a public park. It doesn't have to be perfect at the beginning. It can, but we can demarcate the place for it. And once we have more capital, then we can then make the park look perfect, right?
Mm-hmm.
So thinking of the city as a short-term process and long-term process can really help us also plan better, and especially when you don't have enough capital, that can also help a lot in planning the city over years, right? Because the city is something that's dynamic and something that's always evolving, and the people needs within the city is something that's always evolving. So thinking of the short-term and long-term notions is always a good activity to do in planning cities.
I want to look at the downside to planning. What are the consequences of poor planning? Because we talked about better plan, better cities.
Yeah.
But what consequences are we looking at? If you want to convince me on the streets or a layman on the streets as to why we should change the way things are being done now to what you're proposing now, what are the consequences of us not planning?
I think the consequences of us not planning right can be seen literally in almost every city around the world. Just look around you. A lot of cities are inaccessible financially to a lot of people. That's why we see slums, right? Because people come to the city for a better job, and then when you don't find that better job, or we don't find that housing that you need because it's super expensive, then you just start building your own house, right? This is just like common sense 101, right? So when cities become inaccessible because they're planned poorly, or they're not involving people, or they haven't attracted enough businesses to provide better jobs, then informality is going to start, right? So this is where the inaccessibility, the financial inaccessibility, and also it's unsustainable, right? So you see every city, right? If you go back 50 or 40 years, right, you see, I don't know, 10 or 20% informal settlements. And then 50%, 50 years later, you see 70%. How did this happen, right? Because it's unsustainable to keep planning cities in that way. So the downside of city planning, you can see it expand way more rapidly than the city actually is expanding. So you see the downsides of it expanding. You see the lack of transportation systems, right? So it's inaccessible also to move from one place to another within a city that is not planned right. And most importantly, it doesn't really provide that efficient job market that is the city at its core is, right? People move to a city because I want to have a better opportunity. I want my son to go to a better school. So when we don't plan right, when we don't really attract those businesses, when we don't really provide those infrastructure and then services, then people come to the city and their life is improved by a significant amount, but it's not as improved as they set out to be. And then you see the informality, and then you see all these inefficient jobs that are not really helping an economy, and all this informal economy that are happening. So by not planning well, then you get those cities that are not efficient, not productive, and most importantly, it's very hard to fix them. So it's been estimated that to provide infrastructure after buildings have been built. So if you go into an informal settlement and trying to provide water, you're trying to provide electricity, it's 40% more expensive. So trying to fix the problem of bad planning on a longer term is actually 40% more expensive.
Heba, I want to ask you something.
Tell me.
So you have this charter city. What will stop the same problems that you're referring to of unemployment and and people just moving? Because if you plan, if you have a charter city that has nice rules and it's conducive for business, it will attract investment.
Yeah.
What does that mean? People also migrate to those charter cities.
Yes.
What will stop, you know, people from getting, you know, kicked out from their own cities, or life becoming more expensive for the locals there in the actual charter city?
Yeah.
Because let's be honest, if you're doing it here in Africa, in most parts of Africa, most rural parts, if you put a charter city there, it's the city people that will rush there because they're qualified and they're exposed to it. Yeah. So how will that balance at the end of the day? How will this benefit the locals in the rural parts where you set up a charter city?
Yeah. So it goes back to decentralization, right? Mm. It's really hard to change a law when it's on a national level. It's a lot of process, as it should be, right?
Yeah.
But when you have this decentralization element to it, mm-hmm. and then you have more rules that are on the city level, then it's easier for you to change as you see fit. You see mayors all over the world are complaining about, like, they see the problems, they know, because mayors know, right? Like, they're very connected to the cities and stuff like that. So they see the problem, they hear the solutions from their citizens, but they cannot do anything about it, right? Because they don't have this regulatory domain where they can actually do and change things. And this is where charter cities really work, right? Because then you have a lot of the control over rules on that local level. So when the local authorities see something that is wrong, or see gentrification happening, or see rural immigrants are not as benefiting as much, or see informality happening, they can easily attack those problems. They can either change certain rules or introduce certain regulation that will happen. And this is the thing that we're seeing with cities historically, right? Cities historically have been have developed as city states. They always had authority over governing those cities. And then when we took a lot of authority from those cities and put them on a bit of a more of a national level, this is where all the problems started happening, right? Because then you don't have really control over your city. You kind of have, but you don't really. And this is where charter cities kind of work, because you have that flexibility in changing the rules and creating new rules as you go along. As the we said, you know, planning is short term, long term. It is flexible. It is depending on the investment and the people who come to your city. So right?
You make rules that are biased to the locals.
Exactly. So you make rules that work for you. And this is our major thing. Make rules that work for your people. Mm-hmm. Make rules that work for your investments, right?
Okay.
So, yeah.
All right. You're listening to the Hot Seat Radio program on your hot station, number one for news and entertainment. In case you're just joining us, we are joined by Africa leader Mwanda Piri, who is the urban researcher. And the urban researcher is Heba El Hanafi, I beg your pardon, on the program this morning. As we continue to talk about charter cities as well, Mwanda, I'll come back to you. You identify financing as a major constraint to infrastructure development needed for cities to thrive. How do charter cities solve the financing challenge?
Right. So we advocate for charter cities to be developed via a public-private partnership. Although these days some people will call it the P4s, sorry. Public-private people partnerships, just to ensure that they're very inclusive and that the needs of the people are being incorporated. But nonetheless, what we see, and as you rightly mentioned, Zambia, for instance, is financially constrained. We see this in terms of we're very highly indebted. And at the local authority, you also see that many of the local councils do face, you know, financing constraints, which really doesn't allow them to, you know, invest a lot in terms of expanding infrastructure, providing the municipal services that they're meant to provide. So through a public-private partnership, essentially you're bringing on board the private sector to come in. And what that does is it allows the local authority or the government to leverage the private capital, right, that comes with the private investor. And beyond the private capital, you're also leveraging private, let me rephrase it, you're also leveraging capabilities, because private sector tend to be, you know, experts in various issues in terms of planning, in terms of, you know, providing designs for city developments and things like that. So ultimately, we can solve the financing constraint challenge by, you know, working with the private sector through these public-private partnerships. The private sector can come in, provide the financing needed to actually develop the infrastructure that is required in these cities, create, you know, through their expertise, help to create efficient administrative systems that can then also lead to these enabling business environments where the private sector also, you know, flock in. So in a way, beyond just leveraging the private capital, there's also an element of where the government can actually generate more revenue. Because if you partner with the private sector, if you provide the right infrastructure, right, if you create an environment where residents are moving in, right, where businesses are moving in, setting up, essentially what you see over time is that the land value will go up. Right. So you're able to levy, or rather collect more levies, more fees, if it's your land rates or, you know, whatever it is that, you know, the local authorities will be collecting. So through these, you know, revenue sharing mechanisms, which can be developed between the private urban developer and the local authority, right, you are, one, bringing in the resources needed, but also, you know, generating more revenue, which is really needed. And that revenue can be reinvested back into the city in terms of further expanding infrastructure, providing housing and everything else that we've talked about. So Charter City is a very, quite emphatic on issues of public-private partnerships.
I love it that you bring in the private sector. And every time somebody says anything to do with the private sector, what clicks in my mind first thing is they're here to make a profit. They're not doing this just because they want to do it to save humanity. Mm-hmm. They want to make a profit. They're business people, okay? So let's look at financing here when we're talking about Charter. What's the incentive for private sector to invest in Charter cities?
So this goes back to what I just mentioned in terms of them making a profit, and how do they do it? Through the increase in land value. So private sector, and maybe let me take a step back, right? So just world over, we see new cities coming up, and they're being developed by both private sector as well as, you know, the public sector. And the reason they're doing this is because new cities are being viewed as this new asset class that the private sector can actually invest in. And they're looking to, as you said, make a profit. And how do they do this? The idea is, if you can, you know, create new cities which are thriving, which bring in residents, businesses, that over time, they will be able to recoup their investment, right, through the rise in land values. So as the land value rises, you know, you're able to collect more in terms of your toll fees, for instance. That could be it, you know, from the activity happening in the city. It could be your, you know, your land rates, what you're leaving on, all the economic activities that are happening. It could be business licensing as well. You know, you have a lot of businesses coming in, so more that you can collect from. So in a sense, that is the incentive for the private sector to come in and partner.
Wanda, I'll ask you the same question I asked Heba earlier. How does the local benefit in that scenario? Because, again, won't the locals get kicked out? Won't it become too expensive for the locals to live in? Seeing that we're looking at an African setup here in Zambia, what happens to them?
Yeah, you're asking a very tough question, and I don't want to run away from it entirely, because we have seen this happen. I mean, Shenzhen, which we'll probably talk about a little bit later, right, evolved from this fishing village, right, with about 100 residents. It's in China, and, you know, to a metropolis, what it is today, and it's expensive to live in. So a lot of people are actually just commuting, you know, coming from other areas, moving into, because it has transformed so much, right? You know, there's an increase in land value. It's harder to sort of, you know, get in and actually find affordable accommodation. So that is a reality that we have to be cognizant of. And I think with Charter Cities, what we really emphasize is this model is deliberate in the sense of trying to foster inclusive economic growth. So we are thinking about the locals. Even when we talk about investors, we're not just thinking about foreign investors. You know, this is about property developers, domestic investors also coming to the table to partner. And so the city has to be designed, and this is where the public-private partnership can help. Because if you have the private sector on one hand and you have the public sector, you're trying to ensure that you come up with, you know, a sort of city design that is inclusive, that the interest of the public, which is to ensure that these cities are inclusive, accessible, is really upheld. So you need to put in place, you know, affordable housing, right? Not just these enclaves where, you know, only those who can afford are able to move in. So that is a very critical component. And we can't entirely run away from it, but as Charter Cities, we really do emphasize that in the planning, in the way the city is administered, in the way that linkages are fostered between the businesses that come in, the big ones, with the local firms, right? That they're there, that the locals are able to benefit from either, you know, being able to live in those cities, getting better, cities to live in, or, you know, participating in the economic activities by maybe supplying goods and services to what would be, say, an anchor industry within that city. So we really do emphasize the issue of inclusivity.
Okay. Let's look at revenue generation. How does the private sector generate revenue in a charter mm-hmm. city like that, the setup you just gave us?
Mm-hmm. So maybe just to reiterate what I said previously, right? So as the city thrives, right, as more residents come in, as businesses set up, as infrastructure is provided, what often happens is that, you know, the land value will go up. Like, just to give you, to contextualize it a little bit, if we think about some of the developments within Lusaka, some areas, that years back, right, getting the land would have been, you know, so affordable. Mm-hmm. But as you have more infrastructure coming up, more roads, you know, being done, right, shopping malls coming up, suddenly you find that, you know, getting a plot in a particular area becomes more expensive. Mm-hmm. Suddenly you find that, you know, there might be this increase in the rates that you're paying because the area is becoming more developed. People are moving in. So for the private sector, that is how they make money, because by, you know, administering this city with the public sector, they would have to go into this revenue sharing mechanism. Essentially, you know, sharing whatever taxes or fees are levied within the city. So some of that would accrue to the public sector, right, the local authority, and some of it would accrue to the private investor. And that's one way of incentivizing them to come in, to put their money on the table and actually invest in the city.
Okay. Beyond addressing, you know, financing constraints, what other benefits can be derived from, you know, setting up charter cities?
Ooh, there are quite a number of benefits that we like to talk about.
Let's talk about them. No, I want to hear the benefits.
So the first one I have to mention is, and you started with it, decentralization, right? Mm. So advancing decentralization efforts. As I earlier mentioned in my introductory remarks, charter cities are really about, you know, allowing these local authorities to be the ones to come up with, you know, the rules, localized rules that are suitable for businesses. We've often, you know, heard about constraints in terms of how long it takes to register business. You know, there's some of these regulations that are so onerous. So we're seeing here, you know, allow the local authorities to really innovate. And to some degree, they have scope, but more can be done, right? Especially if they're working with the private sector, more efficient administrative systems, processes can be put in place. Shenzhen, which I talked about, came up with a 24-hour approval system. Can you imagine? Mm. You lodge in an application, 24 hours, you know, there's some sort of ruling. And I think in Mauritius, they'll give you, is it about, I could be mistaken, a number of days. If you don't hear back, the assumption is that, you know, your approval, your application has been approved. Mm. So there are all these innovations that, you know, devolution can allow, can allow the local authorities to be able to undertake. So that's one, right? Allowing, you know, the local authorities to really meet or be responsive to the needs of the businesses as well as their residents. Beyond that, we're talking about improving governance, which comes back to decentralization. So if you have more, you know, autonomy to be able to determine the rules and regulations, you can implement effective reforms. Heber was talking about how difficult it is to change things in an existing system. You can only imagine. If you allow for a greater degree of devolution, right, you can make those reforms where sometimes, you know, it's harder to do at a national level because there are political interests sometimes, there are, you know, private interest groups, there are all these, you know, factors that you're usually, you know, fighting against that inhibit, you know, the ability of reforms to be undertaken. So charter cities, you know, one of the benefits is that you can allow for deeper governance reforms to be undertaken, thereby leading to, you know, more enabling business environments, which leads me to the next benefit, right? So if you have an enabling business environment, you can better attract investors, right? Investors are willing to come in.
As you ask that point, I've got a question for you based on what you just said. What stops a charter city from becoming an elitist city?
All right.
At the end of the day, because obviously you have huge investment from the private sector and they want a certain clientele to generate more revenue. Mm-hmm. What will stop them from making rules that make these cities elitist cities? Because earlier on you alluded to the fact that there'll be suggestions of maybe building affordable accommodation where anybody can afford. But we've seen the drive in the country now is heading towards an elitist kind of, development. When you look at neighborhoods that are gated and housing that's being built, in huge quantities, they put a cap on how much a person earns. So already that kicks out a lot of people.
Absolutely. I mean, I think for me, it would go back to, and some of the cities you're talking about, especially when they're private, right? This is what's going to happen, right? There'll be these, you know, gated communities where, you know, people of a certain income threshold will be living in. And so you really are excluding, you know, some of the other income groups that may not be able to afford. But the idea is, if you develop these cities through this public-private partnership, I need to emphasize this, right? So fine, much as we're emphasizing leveraging, you know, private capital, right, from the private sector. There's a big component of the public sector being involved in this process, being able to steer, you know, how the city will be developed, being able to sit at that table and negotiate and ensure that whatever, you know, cities are being developed, these new charter cities, right, that they are very inclusive. This is something we absolutely emphasize. And charter cities, I mean, we provide technical advisory services. So the design, right, we can ensure, or rather support in ensuring that these cities are designed in such a manner that people are not excluded, that the people that these cities are meant to benefit are not excluded. Because ultimately, going back to our vision, we're doing this so that we can improve governance and alleviate poverty. So that is the main goal. And in this sense, the cities really need to, you know, be very aware of, you know, that inclusivity element.
Okay, let's go back to the benefits. You talked about decentralization. we're past that. Let's look at another benefit.
And I talked about how governance can be improved, right? Through charter cities and this devolved governance system. This next point links to what you were just talking about, right? So inclusive economic growth, where nobody's left behind. So essentially, the way we think about charter cities, as I said, is they need to address the needs of the people. And maybe here I will emphasize two things. So if you're thinking about setting up a charter city, we just don't want cities to be set up anywhere. Mm. You must have a very good economic rationale for this city in order for it to foster the sort of economic benefits we're talking about.
And not leaving anyone behind, because we've heard that political rhetoric here so many times. So I want to get practical examples from you guys as to how this will work without leaving anyone behind.
Yeah, I used it deliberately, by the way, because as you said, it's very popular. I mean, going back to China again, and they used, you know, this model and ultimately lifted about 850 million people out of poverty. So the strategy in terms of urbanization, what China did, let me just take a couple of seconds just to highlight this. So as China was opening up, 1980 designated, it started with four special economic zones. And this is where they're very similar to our model of, you know, charter cities. Shenzhen, which I mentioned before, was designated as a special economic zone, but at city level, right? So very similar to the charter city model. And Beijing at the time, you know, devolved authority to policy making, regulatory making responsibilities to Shenzhen to be able to come up, experiment with, you know, rules better suited to attracting investors. And the local administration did just that. And we saw tremendous growth. In a year, Shenzhen was accounting for about 50% of FDI that was going into China. And I mean, there are some extenuating circumstances, right? China was just moving from being the centrally planned economy to more, you know, trying to experiment with market reform. So you might argue that that might not hold necessarily for us because we're already open, right? But nonetheless, they came up with so many innovations, so many reforms, right, that led to the tremendous growth that I talked about, contributed to poverty alleviation. People were able to be employed in higher productivity jobs. Because remember, when the city expands, when businesses come in, they need laborers, right? They need people to work into those businesses that they'll be setting up. So that's how you're promoting inclusivity. If the businesses are tailored towards youth women, even better, right? So the type of economic activities, say they're anchored on agriculture, could be, right? The locals have an opportunity to participate in the labor markets. Heber was just talking about thinking of cities as labor markets, right? So by absorbing, right, you can address your unemployment problem. Mm. So you're being inclusive in that sense, right? Providing women-led businesses, providing youths with, you know, economic opportunities. By ensuring that, you know, the housing that's provided is, you know, affordable. Again, it goes back to allowing people to live in areas, have decent housing, you know, where you have running water, where you have proper sewerage, you know, sanitation facilities. So this is what we talk about with charter cities, that inclusivity is a key component, and this is one of the benefits. And let me just quickly wrap up maybe with some of the others. I already talked about investment attraction, right? If you talk about improving governance, just one thing to stress here. So empirically, right, if you go through the literature, it has been shown that good governance institutions, right, the rules, laws, are very critical to fostering long-run economic growth. And this has been like a major, you know, determinant of the performance of various countries like Botswana, Rwanda, right, Mauritius versus the rest of sub-Saharan Africa. Mm. These countries have done far much better because the governance systems are better. And this is what we're talking about with charter cities. You improve governance, you devolve authority so that you can have deeper reforms in terms of governance. You can attract businesses, you can create jobs and have better economic outcomes. If you contrast North Korea, South Korea, same issues. You're talking about governance, institutions being a very key determinant. If you contrast, let me go a little bit further, Singapore, Malaysia. I mean, Malaysia is doing relatively well, but the two countries, you know, in terms of how they performed, very different, you know, and they started at some point, they were actually, you know, a collective country and then they broke off. So you see, all these factors bordering on, you know, governance reforms play a huge role in terms of determining the trajectory, economic trajectory of countries. And so, again, this is just some of the benefits that I wanted to highlight. And before I end here, I did earlier mention increased revenue generation for the government, right? Mm. So as the cities thrive, as you know, it's producing more in terms of economic output, you get more taxes, you can levy more on the economic activities, or rather the land in that city. So the government is able to generate more income.
Okay. Yeah. I want to turn to Heba now. Heba, we have cities currently that already have existing problems, which are plenty as well.
Yeah.
Why don't we start with our existing cities first? Why build new cities to bring about efficiencies and better services?
Okay.
Why not work on the cities that we have?
You know, that's a great question. You know why that's a great question? Because 2 years ago when I joined the Charter Cities Institute, I asked them the same question in my interview. I was like, why are you guys working on new cities?
Yeah.
Why don't we work on the cities that exist? And the question and the answer was really simple at this point. It was like, and where are we going to put the new people? And I was like, oh, because we're talking about, you just mentioned, right? 70% of the world is going to be urban by 2050, by 2030, actually. And actually, 90% of that urbanization, 90% of that urbanization is going to happen in African and Asian cities. So we're expecting that a lot of people are going to be coming into cities. A lot of people are going to be looking for better opportunities, better economic opportunities and better services and better things for themselves, for their kids, right?
Mm.
So there is a huge population increase. There is a huge population increase in our African cities, and those people need to go somewhere. And our cities currently are extremely crowded, don't really have space for infrastructures, right? Don't have space to attract investments because they're crowded, they're everywhere.
Mm.
So new cities provide, first off, they help with that population increase.
Don't you think with organization that can be sorted out and we can create space for investment?
Exactly. Like
in the current cities.
Exactly. You can do that, right?
Yeah.
This is something that easily can be done. And also you need a place for the population increase. Where are you going to put people, right? And this is the whole thing. And the other thing with charter cities, right, is that new development, as you mentioned, new development are being developed anyways, right?
Mm.
Gated communities, elitist gateways, and all of these kinds of things. So charter cities are here to make sure that these new developments are just better. Are better for everyone. You know, as you mentioned and as we talked about earlier a little bit, is no one is left behind. So this is the whole idea of charter cities, making the economics and the governance inclusive enough and affordable enough for everyone to attract. So anyway, if you're, like, for instance, right now, for instance, in Egypt, 21 new city development are being built. 21 new cities are being built currently, right? Mm. And we see all over the world a lot of this new city development failing really bad and not being able to attract investment or not being able to attract people. So charter cities come in as a way of making sure that those new developments are inclusive enough, sustainable enough, and most importantly, affordable enough. And charter cities don't also work just on, like, without any, like, connection to the existing city. They actually work a lot on help help solving a lot of the problem that current city exists. As we talked about earlier, that it is 30% more expensive to provide infrastructure once a development is being developed. So if you go into an informal settlement and trying to provide service and infrastructure, it's actually 30% or 30 to 40% more expensive. So Charter City can work as a way to solve those kind of problems, where you can help with reallocation process, where you can help with also immigration, right? Or refugee coming into cities, right? These are new development that you can be developed in a better way to attract those people. So it's not just the a charter city is just like a new city and so on. It's a new city that is responding to the problems and to the challenges that, are within our existing cities. So it's not something that is talking about by itself.
Okay. I still want to find out how we can work around, isn't there an option to, you know, turn our current cities into charter cities? Is that even an option? I'd like to get both your perspectives on this, Mwanda, as well. Yeah. I'd like to get both your perspectives. Is it possible to turn our current cities into charter cities and try and improve on the issues that you've highlighted here? People not getting left behind, putting laws and decentralizing everything and making sure that even the people that are already in the existing cities actually get to benefit from what is being proposed in the charter cities.
Mm-hmm. No, I'll try to answer it a little bit differently, right? It may not be very direct, only because, I mean, with existing cities, right, you already have a local administration in place, right? And we're talking about a public-private partnership.
Okay.
Here, the way the private sector would probably come in is, for instance, you can, you know, commission some road to be done maybe by the private sector. You know, this build, operate, transfer system sometimes that we tend to use, right? So the private sector maybe makes the return from the toll fees, you know, sharing that with the government. That could be one way. It becomes a little bit more intricate. I wouldn't say it's not doable. It just becomes a bit more intricate.
Okay.
But charter cities, the model itself can be applied in existing cities. I think Heba was just alluding to this a little bit. So we have wide-ranging applications. You can literally use a charter city model, for instance, to upgrade informal settlements, right? Mm. So these become more of satellite cities. So within the city, then you have, you know, a semblance of a charter city. If you're taking, you know, one of your highly informal settlements, turn it around and provide better housing infrastructure, providing the municipal services, water, you name it, and then maybe allow that to sort of be governed under different rules, you know, that are promoting the businesses around that area. That's one way of doing it. There's also, you know, what we're calling rural hubs, for instance, right, where you can come up with small farm cities. And we have an affiliated project in Malawi, which I think is just fascinating. So essentially, and this is does not even involve the public sector, by the way.
Mm.
It's, you know, investors who are partnering with other landowners, the individuals, people like you and I who own land, right? And they're maximizing, you know, the value of this land in terms of investing in these aquaculture projects. They're looking at horticulture as well. And you'd be amazed, they've actually taken graduates, the youth, right, training them. They're the farm managers. They're producing tomatoes. They're producing, cultivating fish, right, if that's the right terminology. But you see that there are all these applications. And essentially, they want as well, you know, devolved rules to be able to determine the type of policies, you know, that will be suited to them thriving. And they're also looking to provide municipal services. So semblances of charter cities, but within, you know, existing districts, within existing cities to some degree. Another point, if you look at, say, resettlement hubs, right, you can have cities that are anchored on resettlement hubs. Resettlement may be coming about as a result of refugees or, you know, internally displaced persons. Climate change, sometimes people have to be relocated, right? Mm-hmm. So you cluster them in a particular area, but what are they going to do? You know, should they just depend on being, you know, given some sort of relief assistance? But start thinking about how those areas can be transformed, the sort of infrastructure that can be provided, the sort of employment opportunities that they can engage in. So taking the charter city model, especially issues around governance, you know, so that these areas become more dynamic. So in a way, can be applied to existing cities, but may not be applied necessarily in terms of, you know, a new administrative city.
Okay, yeah. That's understood. Okay. So what are the major roadblocks to the idea, and how realistic is this, Mwanda?
Oh, you talked about some of them, actually. it's very ambitious, we have to say that. But, one of the things we pride ourselves on is thinking out of the box, coming up with, you know, transformative ideas. And I think this new government also, wants that, transformative ideas that can really propel, you know, economic development. Because if we do things as we have done them, nothing will really change. So we need some transformative ideas. So in terms of challenges, when interests are not well aligned, right, that can pose a problem in terms of, you know, the ability of this to actually take off. So what makes Zambia great, for instance, is we do see this drive to promote decentralization. We do see this emphasis on working with the private sector. Mm. We do see this emphasis as well on promoting inclusive and sustained economic growth. So if you are able to align the interests of what charter cities can foster with that of the host government, then the, you know, probability of success becomes greater, I would say. Beyond that, issues of illegitimacy, right? So going back to your issue of how inclusive is it, if the cities are not, you know, leading to a process where they're considered to be legitimate in offering better prospects, right, meeting the needs of the people, then, you know, your chances of success would be much, much lower. Beyond that, issues of land ownership and autonomy. So often, you know, we try not to use the word autonomy as well, because it has this connotation of, why do you want this to be so, you know, distinct on its own? But really, a good way of just understanding it is, we're just talking about devolving authority. Who knows better, you know, what a particular area needs than the local administration? So just give them more power to be able to do things better. That's essentially what we are talking about. Mm. So land ownership, if you look at, you know, your land tenure systems, traditional land, you know, some of those can be bottlenecks to success, right? But beyond that, I think if you do not respect the constitution as well, I think charter cities, we emphasize... I do know for a fact that we do emphasize, you know, respect for the constitution, respect for criminal law as well that is prevailing in the country, as well as, you know, international treaties that the country could be party to. So we work within all those, you know, areas, within those legal provisions. And I think another thing that I just wanted to highlight is if we think about, you know, developing the cities in a very inclusive manner, then, you know, it's more durable, but certainly it doesn't come without challenges. But a lot of people have to be involved, as I said, maybe instead of triple P, thinking about the four P's. So public, private, people, partnerships. Yeah.
Okay. We've talked about charter cities for over an hour now.
Yeah.
I want to know from both of you, where has this idea worked? Where has it been piloted and it's working?
All right. So in terms of, you know, Charter City as it is designed, it's sort of difficult to pinpoint to a particular, you know, case study. We do have what are very close to the idea of charter cities or special economic cities, as Heba and I like to refer to them as now.
Yeah.
So very close. I talked about Shenzhen earlier, right? Mm-hmm. A whole city designated mm-hmm. as a special economic zone. Again, going back to, you know, us thinking of charter cities as being this next generation of special economic zones. So instead of a particular vote to the administration there to be able to experiment, to come up with rules, reforms. They experimented with so much. They implemented commercial land reforms. They implemented, you know, wage reforms, issues to do with labor law. They eliminated price controls. There's a lot that was done just at that city level, you know, where ordinarily you would see this at a national level. But they did this. So we think of Shenzhen as closely representing our concept of charter cities. But Just to say, I think in Nigeria, we have an affiliated project there in Inimba. It's more of a special economic zone, but designed to be a charter city in the sense that element of devolved authority has been granted to this city development project. So in that sense, you know, embodying the elements of the charter city model. But I would say we think of Hong Kong as being very similar. We think of Dubai, you know,
Singapore
as well, city state, very similar. But a perfect, you know, replica of the model, maybe not yet, but we hope soon, perhaps in Malawi, yeah. Zambia, who knows? But I hope that answers the question.
Okay. I'm going to ask the people to join our conversation. If you have a contribution, a comment, or question for Heba and Wanda, you can give us a call now on 0974-870-877 or 0950-955-877. Be part of this conversation. If you're watching us live on our social media platforms and you have a question, just feel free to type on the live feed. And I'm going to read the questions live right here on your hot station, number one for news and entertainment, to our panelists this morning. We're live in Eastern Province on Kanela FM in Lundazi, to be specific. We're also live on Kwitu FM on 93.3 FM in Lusaka and surrounding areas. So give us a call now on 0974-870-877 and 0950-955-877. Those lines will get you through to the Hot Seat Radio program for Tuesday. Heba, I want to throw a question at you. You talked about different applications of the charter city model. How could the charter cities model be used to address informal settlements?
Yeah, that's a great question, right? And it takes us back to actually looking at informal settlements, right? So what are informal settlements? Mm. Informal settlements are people who came here looking for better jobs, better services. They couldn't find affordable housing. They couldn't find the jobs that would give them the enough capital to participate in the formal markets. Mm-hmm. So they just built their own things, right? And they've been doing it for in certain cities for 70 years, in other cities for 50, it depends. So if you actually look at what an informal settlement is, they also have a lot of devoured authority, right? They have a lot of devoured, they are a very decentralized area. And then when you look at a lot of the relocation project that's been happening all over sub-Saharan Africa, or a lot of the approaches to solving solving the informal settlement problem, a lot of the literature tells us is that a huge problem is that you build new areas for people, right? And you reallocate them, but you forget a huge part of it, which is the governance. That those people operate in certain ways, they operate in their own rules, they have been doing that for years and years and years. Mm. And then when you reallocate them or you're trying to solve this problem, they're really not that involved, and then they don't have the kind of authority that they did in their own settlement. They don't have the jobs that they created, and this is where a charter city comes in, right? Because a charter city is a decentralized model. So when you're talking about reallocation process, and then you involve a governance aspect to it, and this is where the informal settlements can work again, or the reallocation process is not just building, then just moving people, and here you are. It's just, as Mwanda said a lot, public, private, and people partnerships. Mm. So then the people are involved, and then there is an element of governance, which is a huge problem of all of this reallocation process, is that governance is not a part of it, investments is not a part of it. So you move people, for instance, in a different area, but you don't provide them with the jobs that actually brought them to the informal, or the lack of jobs or the lack of employment access that brought them to the informal settlements in the first place. So charter cities can be used as a way to attract investment to these reallocation processes, to think about governance in an innovative and different way for people who have been living in a certain way for years and years and years. And then you can ensure a sustainable solution to informal settlements, not just a building solution or a housing solution. So this is where charter cities can approach all of these different, not just economic, but also social problems, right? In a way that can really solve those problems on a longer term, on a sustainable term, on financially, environmentally, and socially.
Okay. What is the core of your work in Zambia, and why did you choose to base your Africa operations out of Zambia? Out of all the countries in Africa, you decided to come to Zambia. Why, Mwanda?
Yeah, well, so it's the alignment of interest. And I'm very thrilled, by the way, that, you know, this decided to, in terms of the regional office, to be set up in my home country. But yes, it's the alignment of interest, as I'd earlier alluded to, right? So we see decentralization being a very key development objective of the government. And even before the government, we see this in our long-term development plans, the Vision 2030. We've seen it in the various medium-term development plans as well. So, you know, I mean, for this to succeed, and you talked about this, you know, you sort of need to align interests. So Zambia, and even now we talk about Zambia being open for business, you know, private sector drive is there. So why not Zambia? Which other country can we really think about exactly. that, you know, holds a lot of prospects. So hence why. But yeah, so talking about our work, so as I'd mentioned before, we are really trying to support countries to implement this development model. As you said in your preamble, Peter, it can really address some of the 21st century challenges that we see, issues of inequality, issues of poverty, issues of unemployment, addressing issues of, you know, displacement, migration, you name it. So this is very innovative, out-of-the-box thinking. We are working with the government. I don't know if it's too soon to say that, but so what we're trying to do is work with the government and other key stakeholders, right, private sector, to really pilot this initiative in Zambia. So perhaps see a special economic city being developed in Zambia, you know, where we can test this out. And something that we perhaps didn't mention is how charter cities are really thought of as also being a bit experimental. The idea is, if this succeeds, right, implemented at national level, this is something China did very well. When the reforms were working in Shenzhen and the other zones, it implemented more economic reasons and then implemented national reforms. So the idea is, you test it out. If it works, I mean, even better, right? Then you scale it up, because then you can actually test and see that this is leading to better outcomes.
But what gives you the confidence that this could work in Zambia?
What gives us the yes. confidence, so let me qualify that, is that, as I said, I apologize, I'm going to reiterate quite a few of my points, but it goes back to, there's a drive to decentralize, there's a drive to promote private sector development, there's a drive to ensure that administrative processes, regulatory processes are more efficient. It should be easy to set up a business. It shouldn't be too onerous. We shouldn't have, you know, multiplicity of licensing, licenses, what else, regulations, you know, being performed by different institutions that could be streamlined. So we do see that in Zambia, you know, the prospects for this happening, very good. Also, Zambia is rapidly urbanizing, right? We talked about the global statistics, Africa. Population in terms of just population growth, 2.8%. Urbanization growth rate about 3.4%. We're nearly, you know, careening towards the 50% mark in terms of, you know, urbanization. So there's a demand for, you know, new cities that can provide better economic prospects. Heba talked about people moving. We saw when the census, the employment opportunities came up, the youths that lined up, right, looking for economic opportunities. We do see the demand for, you know, better employment prospects. And so all these factors sort of, you know, give us a very good rationale justification to try to, you know, implement this here.
On what Mwanda just said, right, there is a huge international trust in Zambia currently. There is a huge investment that are trusting that this is the country where they should come in and they should start building things, even on the national and regional land developers. There is a huge trust in the country right now. So not that we're not just building on the current national decentralization agenda and all of the needs that the government is already outlined, and this is what drove us here. It's like, they already are thinking on the same thing that we're thinking. They're thinking of the long-term urbanization, they're thinking of the importance of decentralization, they're thinking the importance of attracting investment and creating great jobs. So it's very aligned with our ideas, but also the international trust that is happening in Zambia right now. And, you know, everyone's looking at what's happening with the Kwacha and what's happening with Zambia being open to business. So
yeah, positive investor sentiments.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Give us a call. 0974-870-877. It's 0950-955-877. You can also send us your messages via our WhatsApp line, which is 0974-870-877. If you want to be part of this conversation, you can do so. We're live in Eastern Province on Kanela FM on 97.7 FM. We're also live on Kwitu FM on 93.3 FM in Lusaka. Live on 87.7 here in Lusaka. But countrywide, catch us on DSTV channel 912 and GoTV channel 301. Those platforms will allow you to be part of the Hot Seat radio program. And today, we're looking at something very interesting. We're looking at charter cities. Obviously, we have Africa leader who's Mwanda Pio, who's joined us, and urban researcher Heba El Hanafi in studio today on the Hot Seat radio program right here on your hot station, number one for news and entertainment. I want to find out from both of you, are you involved in any other African country besides Zambia?
Yes. So as I'd mentioned earlier, this is a regional office that we've set up in Lusaka, Zambia, and we're looking to support the entire sub-Saharan Africa. Very ambitious in that sense. In Malawi, we've already made some great strides. We're working with the National Planning Commission there, which is under the equivalent of the Ministry of Finance and National Planning here. And Malawi recently piloted its secondary cities plan. So it aims to develop 8 secondary cities so that it can foster broader, you know, economic growth. And so we're working with them to apply the charter city model to these cities, see how we can turn them into special economic cities so that they thrive. So Malawi is one country. I talked about Nigeria. I think one of the countries we started engaging with quite early on when charter cities was established. Heba knows better than I do because she's been there longer.
Okay.
But yes, so Nigeria being one of them, maybe she would want to add to that. Beyond Nigeria, we have been talking to the Gambia as well. With the association there recently signed some memorandum of understanding to, you know, implement this initiative. Kenya as well, working with the government there to support this initiative. Zimbabwe, we're still in the courtship stage, but yes, they are equally looking to sort of apply, you know, these elements because they see urbanization being very critical. So they want to go beyond your typical zones, right? And really, you know, consider cities, but, you know, that are of a special jurisdiction. Beyond these countries, obviously Zambia itself.
And I think there is a need, like, there is now countries and cities are seeing more that the traditional solution and traditional approaches to cities that we've been doing for years and years and years and they've been failing for years and years and years are not going to work anymore. Now we need to be innovative. Now we need to be bold. And I think that's why there is a lot of attraction with all of the cities that and all of the countries that Mwanda just mentioned. And that's why the work is going off and have a lot on our plate.
Okay. Let me pick up a call. Good morning. You're through to the Hot Seat radio program.
Morning, PZ. This is Harrison.
Harrison, good morning to you.
Morning. I wanted to understand correctly, are these people saying that they want cities with a different government system from what we already have? Can they please explain a little bit more on that?
Okay.
Yeah, because, I mean, why have a different governance system for a small jurisdiction? Which is, and that means it's going to be totally different from the rest of the country, right? In terms of law.
Okay.
I think that's a bit of a problem.
Okay.
So let them explain further on that.
All right, they will do so, Harrison. Thank you very much for your call.
Thanks.
Your hot station, number one for news and entertainment. Give us a call, 0974-870-877, 0950-955-877. Those lines get you through to the Hot Seat radio program this morning. We would like to hear from you. Give us a call. Good morning.
Hello, good morning. Good morning, Amanda.
Good morning.
I'm okay. I'm Jimmy here.
Jimmy, please go ahead with your question or contribution.
Actually, I've developed the skin implant, but my worry is that this project has not been piloted anywhere. But I don't know how it's going to be implemented. Let me just say in which of the electrical cars, I know the government wanted to open up that kind of arrangement. Why can't they shoot in that kind of development? Like in a couple of days, maybe they can have one
Jimmy, your line is breaking there. We can't hear you.
Okay. Let me take that one.
All right. Thank you. I don't know. I think you got the first part of the question. The first part of his concern, rather. It's 0974-870-877, 0950-955-877. We'd like to hear from you this morning. What's your take regarding the conversation we're having regarding charter cities this morning? It's 0974-870-877, 0950-955-877. I think I'll allow you to tackle the ones that came through.
Yeah, sure. Thank you. So Harrison, right? Mm. One of the sticking points, indeed. So it's not really that it's a different government system, as we said, because it's a public-private partnership, right? The government is involved. It's just that what we're really trying to do is beyond leveraging the private capital, it's also improving capabilities. So some of the constraints, in terms of being able to adequately plan cities and ensure that they are responsive to emergent needs, right, to the expanding urban population, to institutional gaps, really comes down to the fact that sometimes their hands are tied and you really can't implement the sort of reforms you'd want to. So by partnering with the private sector, the idea is you can have a sort of a blended administrative authority, right, that can allow for more efficient administrative processes to be put in place, more efficient commercial regulations. You know, working with the private sector, that tends to introduce more efficient processes that way. So, building capabilities, there's that skills transfer that's happening. Mm. But also allowing the cities to be very dynamic. So if business needs change, they can respond quite quickly. You don't have to rely and go back to central government, to have any key, changes done. And this is one of the key distinctions with the special economic zones. And I'd like Harrison to think of them as we do the multi-facility economic zones. They are different, right? The rules that apply are meant to be different. That's essentially what we want. And it's very targeted in that sense, because you're hoping to have these places where things will be done better, infrastructure will be better, so that investors come in, right? So similarly with these cities, I mean, the first best solution is if you can implement the reforms at a national level. But I think Heather and I have already talked about some of the constraints to being able to do that, right? So where you can't do that, you say, fine, in this particular area, let's try to experiment, do things better. And if it works, apply this everywhere. So yes, there's that element of, how is the administration set up? But as I said, the public sector is still heavily part of this process, right? We talk about the people being part of this process as well, so that their interests are still met. I don't know if that helps to allay Harrison's concerns.
It's also like building on what they just said, right? What we're trying to do is making sure that the right people are doing the right thing.
Mm.
And making sure that those processes, these institutions, and these partnerships are the most efficient, are done in the most efficient way for those cities to actually thrive. So this is where the devoured authority comes in, right? Making sure that the right people do the right thing at the right time as well, right? It's not, we can't wait for years and years and years for one rule that is not working to change. And this is why decentralization matters, right?
Okay. It's 0974-870-877, 0950-955-877. You can reach us on those two lines, and Mwanda and Heba are here to just respond to your concerns. Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
Morning. Please switch off your radio.
Hello?
Hello? Okay, we can hear you better now. What's your name? Hello? Your radio is still on. We can barely hear you. There's feedback. Please do switch off your radio if you want to get in touch with us and have a conversation, because we won't be able to hear you clearly because of the feedback coming from your radio. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning to you. What's your name?
Yes, I'm Bushe.
Your name again?
Bushe.
Bushe.
Yes.
Bushe, please go ahead with your concern or question.
Yeah, it's quite interesting, but it's also be asking ourselves questions. Why now? Are they preparing for themselves to migrate because of instability wherever they are coming from whatever. I think we are already comfortable with what we are, which is our own things, or the government's important. So if you are here with charter, it's like hiring. Put those cities, who come and hire those cities, stay there. And if they stay there on those hired cities, it will be difficult to remove them. This is easy to poke the harams of this world we hear about. Is it a way of... it's really confusing.
Okay,
where are those people going to go, those cities, those places? Where should they be displaced?
Okay.
And put those things. Are you sure you allow a person like me to be there? Future is going to see the
okay.
Don't see.
All right.
Yes, Wushu, you will be allowed.
Understandable.
Okay. Wushu,
yes.
Thank you for those questions. I think Mwanda and Heba will tackle them for you, okay? All right. Let's see if we can get in one more. It's 0974-70877, 0950-955-877. Those lines get you through to the Hot Seat Radio program this morning. If you have any contributions regarding what we are talking about this morning, you can give us a call. Or maybe you can, respond to... okay, now the phone's ringing again. I think we have... Hello, good morning.
Yes, morning, Pizzy. I'm Morgan again.
Morgan, welcome back. We can hear you clearly now. Please go ahead.
Okay. Morning to the two panelists.
Good morning, Morgan.
Morning.
Yes. I wanted to find out, does it mean you are just advocates for upcoming or new cities? Or maybe you also advocate for the already developed cities to be redesigned? Let's say I'm referring to, like, currently we have the Osaka Master Plan, the redesign, the redevelopment of the city. Yes, the city has already developed, but there are areas where the government feels changes can be made in certain aspects of the development that has already been done. Like the ring roads, those were not there. So do you also advocate for already developed cities, already developed cities to be redesigned so that they can take on the status of the cities that you are talking about? Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. I'll allow you to tackle those.
All right. Thank you so much for those questions. Let me start with Wusha because he posed a very controversial question. So, I mean, let me proudly say first off that I'm Zambian, so I hope that helps. So not looking to really, bring in people. I mean, the people we want to bring in are the people that don't have good housing, right? And beyond that, so let me take a step back, right? You can have greenfield in the sense of being very greenfield.
Mm.
As I said, let me keep relating this to your MFES program, right? The Lusaka South came up, right? People were not living there. It was an area. Development started. Infrastructure was put in place. Residents set up. Residents started taking up land, right, to build. Businesses flocked in. Very similar, right? So you have some land which can really be greenfield in that sense. And all you're saying is, how do we better attract investments, right? We're coming from the pandemic, there's been a lot of slowdown in terms of, investors putting out their monies in different jurisdictions because of, the challenges we've been facing globally. Also sometimes, we talked about business regulations. We've heard on the Red Hot Breakfast many people lamenting about regulations being very onerous, right? Mm. Registering a business is very difficult. So how do you, you know, eliminate all those constraints? The best way of thinking about the type of reforms that these cities would be addressing is to think about the major bottlenecks that you have tried, but, you know, you're sort of failing to address at a national level. So how can you do that at, you know, a more localized level, right? And in the process, how do you then bring in investors? Because we do need investment. We do need more infrastructure development. So that is the best way I can put it. So the people you're really looking, the first movers, you know, to go into those cities, it should be Zambians. It should be Malawians, wherever we're doing this, right? They're the ones. If it's semi-developed, right, not very greenfield, mm. right, you already have some residents that would benefit from businesses coming in, right? So if employment opportunities become available, who should take them up? Who should, you know, relocate into those spaces? It's people moving. Instead of coming just, you know, to Lusaka that, you know, everybody wants to be here because things are, you know, economic prospects are better. The idea is you start creating these other places where you can have also good economic prospects, where people can say, instead of moving from, you know, Chinsali or the Copper Belt, the migration we've seen to Lusaka, they're moving to, you know, these are the spaces that become more dynamic. So it's really, and I hope that really helps to clarify or allay some of the concerns. Yeah. Heba, I don't know if you want to tackle it, but I'm happy to weigh in on it as well. The second question from, is it Morgan?
Yes, it's it was Morgan, and it was a really interesting question, right? Mm. Because, yes, our major work is advocating or helping or working with this new city development and this new development. But we're also proposing, as we said, the charter city model is quite flexible. Mm. And we're also proposing charter cities as a way to solve some of the challenges that the current cities are facing. We expanded a little bit on how can charter cities help with informal settlements in other countries, how can charter cities help as a model to solve the refugee crises that are happening there. So yes, we are advocating for new city development, but we're also proposing as a solution for a lot of the current problems that need innovation and that need that element of decentralization to solve in our current cities.
Okay. All right. I know we just have 3 minutes left for us to end this program, but I want to find out from you, both of you, that is, what is the way forward?
Before I get to that, I think there was a question from Jimmy. Oh, I don't know if we addressed it.
Oh, okay.
Saying concerns about it. No. That this has not been piloted. I think that's the only part I got. Mm. And I mean, yeah, absolutely. In the sense of, you know, the way it would be designed, right? And Heba has just mentioned issues of flexibility. I think it's always good to be very adaptable. We've talked about some examples, you know, where you've had charter-like cities, right? Shenzhen that we mentioned, you have your Dubais, your Hong Kong, all these cities which are thriving in that sense. So, and really it goes back to this being very innovative, and we have key challenges that need out-of-the-box, you know, ideas, and this is what we're really trying to advance. But so in terms of what is next, we have a number of initiatives actually coming up. We plan to officially launch our office. We haven't done so. We're no longer the new kid on the block, but nonetheless, we think it's very befitting to sort of, you know, kick off with some sort of launch. So they should be coming up later in November. Beyond that, we are working with the Zambia Technology Sector Working Group. There's supposed to be an African Renaissance Conference, so we're giving support to that conference, will be a part of it. So these are some of the key initiatives. The big one, as I said, is really to try to see how this can be piloted here, looking at potential site locations, you know, areas with prospects for, you know, pushing forth very, you know, dynamic cities or such developments. And the idea is that this will be a very inclusive consultative process, you know, where all the key players, government, local authorities are part of this initiative. We have what we call Africa's Next 50 Cities Coalition. Mm. So this is just a national coalition that aims to address the challenges of the 21st century. We have seen coalitions address various, or rather coalitions come together to address various development concerns. If it's your Millennium Development Goals or Sustainable Development Goals, or, you know, COP, what it aims to achieve. With Next 50 Cities, it's a similar, you know, ideology that people need to come together, the people that are needed to ensure that cities are well planned, that they are financed, that they are built and well governed, so that, you know, we foster human flourishing. So this coalition is really looking at supporting new city development projects from conception, during the due diligence in terms of feasibility studies, ensuring that they are bankable projects, and that ultimately, you know, we move to a situation where the investment is being done and people have greater economic opportunities.
Okay.
Oh, and
One of also like the kind of projects we're working with, since we opened the regional office, we've been fascinated by Lusaka, and it is a greenfield development. It is a city that is built on a certain planning paradigm. So we're also soon launching the Lusaka Urban Lab, which should be aimed at researching the cities, bringing the different stakeholders together, the people and the government and the private sector, to try to really understand what the city needs and what it needs to move forward, and doing a lot of just research and try to really learn and understand the city that we're working with, and have it as a case study for a lot of the piloted projects that we hopefully aim to launch.
Okay. Heba and Wanda, I'd like to thank you very much for coming through to the Hot Seat Radio program.
Thank you.
All right, there you have it. That's our show for this week. We'll be back. That's our show for Tuesday, actually. We'll be back with another exciting edition of the Hot Seat on Thursday, right here on your Hot Station number one for news and entertainment.
That was the Hot Seat. Don't forget to join next week at the same time, exclusive to Hot 87.7.